sombríos días de socavón, noches de tragedia, desesperanza y desilusión se sienten en mi alma. Así mi vida pasando voy, porque minero soy, minero que por mi patria doy toda mi...
In today's program, we are talking with Elena McGrath, historian specialized in Latin American history and assistant professor at Union College. Focused on the mining city of Corocoro, Elena explores at a granular level the effects of the revolution on people's everyday lives. Where before the revolution, decisions within the company were made by a small number of bureaucrats, after 1952, the mining union became central to the company's decisions. This change had profound implications for the lives of the workers, their wives, their children, and even their extended families. This implied, for example, access to school, to breakfast, to uniforms for the miners' kids, access to pensions and healthcare for their families, and even access to being better treated and represented in the courts. Thus, Elena masterfully answered the question, what a difference does a revolution make? While transformative, McGrath warns us that this change did not favor all citizens similarly. The distribution of these rights was exclusive and hierarchical and available to those associated with the mine, leaving many others marginalized and behind. Elena, thank you so much for coming to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, Carmen.
So I wonder if we could first start talking about how did you become interested in studying Bolivia?
Well, so when I graduated from college, I got a little bit of money from my college to go do an internship with a film production company called Landlocked Films, and they were making a documentary at that time in Coroico, actually, about the Yungas and the kind of what's become known as the death road in the Yungas. And so I lived in Coroico for about 3 months, and that was in 2006. And so that was a time of pretty massive transformation in Bolivia. That was a time where there were a lot of preparations in progress for rewriting the constitution for the Constituent Assembly. This was early on in Evo Morales's presidency. And I showed up in Bolivia just sort of amazed at all of the different kinds of political conversations that were going on around me and all of the sort of effervescence and the ideas, and that everyone I talked to had a pretty clear sense of the past. There have been a lot of problems in this country in the past, and we're actually transforming the country right now. Wow. And I ended up having those kind of conversations sort of across all sorts of different, a lot of different places and across the political spectrum. And of course, when I was there, I was helping do interviews with people in one of the communities a community that had been founded by former miners who had lost their jobs in the 80s and had moved into the Yungas to do agriculture, to grow coca, some of whom were sort of making their living running restaurants along this road. And so, you know, I was out of school. I had no plans to go back to graduate school, but I fell in love with Bolivia and I wanted a reason to be there. And I wanted a reason to go back that wasn't just about travel.
Arrived like a tourist and then you became a researcher in the
process. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to just be here taking pictures. I want to, like, it was really fun to be able to go to, a local historian in a place like Coroico or Yolosa and say, hey, what do you know? And to ask questions. And I had studied history as an undergraduate, and my thesis advisor as an undergraduate was actually David Garrett. He's a historian of colonial Peru. So I was already excited about the Andes. So it took me a little while to get to graduate school, but when I did, I had this clear idea in my head of, I want to know why Bolivia sort of seemed like such a, Bolivia was a place where people were having these intensely political conversations and where history seemed so important to what the project was that was going forward. I wanted to understand what was happening when I had been there. And so I applied with sort of vague ideas about writing some sort of how Bolivians understood their history. I don't even really remember how I applied to graduate school, but one of the first books that I read when I was a graduate student was, of course, June Nash's We Eat the Mines and the Mines Eat Us. And it's this classic ethnography, mid-20th century ethnography that she did in Oruro with a group of miners. And it raised all sorts of questions for me. If you've read anything about the Bolivian Revolution, there's this sense of, well, it's obvious that the workers would be leading the revolutionary vanguard of this revolution. And a lot of the histories that were written about the Bolivian Revolution of 52, at least the ones I was reading first, were written in the vein of sort of Guillermo Lora and sort of thinking about it in Marxist terms and taking for granted this idea that the workers are going to be the group that has the most revolutionary consciousness and they're going to push the revolution forward. And I was really curious about how that came to be as a kind of narrative about what happened in the revolution. But the more I researched about the revolution of 52, the more I felt like the idea of who was a worker, who benefited from the revolution, what did the revolution mean to different people, was a much more complicated question than I could have ever imagined. So that sort of started me off a little bit. When I got to Bolivia to do some preliminary dissertation research, I had a lot of conversations with people at the Comibol archives. Comibol is the nationalized mining company that was created after the revolution of 52. It was created in 1953 out of most of, but not all of, the major mining concerns in Bolivia. And when those mines were shut down, mostly shut down in the 1980s, there was a kind of concerted effort among some people to try to keep that memory. And there's a pretty huge archive in El Alto of documents from that national mining company. And at the time that I was doing my research, it wasn't that easy to get access to them. They weren't entirely open to researchers. But I talked to the head of the archives at the time, who was Huracan Ramirez, and former union leader. And I was able to go in and get access to some of the sort of institutional documents, some of the union documents that way. But I also, as anyone who's done research in Bolivia knows, there's often a lot of bureaucratic lag time between saying, I'm going to get access to this thing and actually being able to see the documents. So I spent a lot of time waiting to get into various archives that I thought I was going to be able to get into, hanging out at the Archivo La Paz at the university and just kind of looking around to see what I could find. And what I found was municipal records and judicial records from some mining communities in, or from mining cities in the Department of La Paz. And so one of those that I found was a copper mining city called Corocoro.
Just to give a sense of where is Corocoro, it's almost in the border with Chile. Is that right?
It's almost on the border with Chile. It's sort of northwest of La Paz. It's probably about 13,000 feet elevation. It's in the Altiplano, and it is sort of on the highway towards Arica. And it used to be, when there was a train between La Paz and Arica, there was a branch line that came off to Corocoro. And so when the railroad was one of the major forms of transportation in Bolivia, Corocoro was an important sort of transit hub, an important commercial center for conducting trade with the coast.
What kind of ores were extracted from Corocoro?
So Corocoro is unique in that it's a copper mine. It's not a tin mine. And so most of the most profitable, the biggest mining concerns in Bolivia for most of the 20th century was tin. And the story of 20th century mining is about the rise of tin to replace earlier mining booms in silver. And these days in the 21st century, there's still a lot of mining, but it's very often just like a selection of trace minerals, right? It's tin, it's silver, it's a bunch of other things. In Corocoro, it's copper. And Corocoro is one of the few places that has native copper deposits in the world. One of the other places is actually in the Midwest of the United States, mm-hmm. in Michigan and northern Minnesota, I think. So Corocoro has copper deposits, which made it a slightly different kind of mining enterprise than a lot of the tin mines. And in the early part of the 20th century, it was mined by a series of Chilean companies and then a British-French joint company called the Corocoro United Copper Mines. They mined until the Great Depression, until the mm-hmm. economic crisis in 1930, they closed down. And after that, the mines were bought out by a subsidiary of the American Smelting and Refining Company, which if you look at sort of Latin American history, and if you look at US mining history, that's a really big name, right? Like you have copper mines all over the American Southwest, but it's not actually a major player in Bolivian mm-hmm. mining history. And in fact, the most important mines in Bolivia were Bolivian owned. That is an interesting data point to think about, partially because one of the major sort of driving narratives of nationalization and sort of nationalist-based politics was to return the mines to the people, or to give the mines, control of the mines to the Bolivian state. And in many ways, the Bolivian state didn't have control over the mines before the revolution, but they were Bolivian companies, as opposed to, for example, in Chile, when the Allende government nationalized copper mines.
So I want to hear a little bit more about your findings of your work now.
Yeah, I think one of the main contributions of my work is to look at a history of what happened to mining cities before, during, and after the revolution, and to look just beyond the workers themselves and to look beyond the unions themselves and to think about these cities as really communities. And so to think about not just what happened to the people who were working underground in the mines, but their wives and children and their extended families, and in many cases, their siblings and parents, and to really understand that when the mines were nationalized, and for example, when a minimum wage was guaranteed or subsidies of food in the company store was guaranteed, that didn't just affect, 15,000 men, it affected all of their dependents and all of their extended families. And it really transformed the economic life of a lot of different parts of the country and also the social life of a lot of different parts of the country. And so what I ended up doing with my manuscript, I'm working on a book called Devil's Bargains, is to use this small copper mining city, Corocoro, which is, as I've already said, it's a sort of peripheral city. It's a smaller place, but what it allows you to see is how the mines interacted with the rural landscape of Bolivia. And so in this case, Corocoro is also in Pacajes, which is a densely populated province that has a lot of rural communities, that has a lot of agrarian communities, a lot of Aymara-speaking indigenous communities, and some haciendas before the revolution too. And so to look at the interaction between the mine workers, the merchants who were in that city, and also the indigenous communities that surrounded it, and to really take seriously the idea that these were not distinct groups. These were groups that had kind of differing relationships to the state, different relationships to economic livelihoods, but were very enmeshed. And so the main findings that I have is really to show how when the mines were nationalized after the revolution, it did profoundly affect the economic and the social life of a peripheral city like Corocoro. And it functionally created a new group of power holders. And this was a kind of hybrid group of mostly young men who were often, they were mine workers, but they were also often merchant sons. So they had relationships to the workers as well as the merchant class. And they were able to take advantage of what happened in the revolution of 1952.
I have a question in the middle. We know that the mines that were nationalized, as you were saying, were the ones in Yayagua, Siglo XX, that belonged to Patiño, Hoshi, Laramayo. What happened with the mines in Corocoro that did not belong to the three big mine owners?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think I should probably back up several steps. And so the mines that belonged to Patiño and Aramayo and Ostrild, they were nationalized, but so were the mines belonging to the American Smelting and Refining Company. So it was in 1952, Corocoro was a major mining center, and it was one of the places where, you know, the union sent representatives. They took part in a lot of the sort of national mining conversations that were happening. And so Corocoro was one of the first mines to be nationalized. But what happened as a result of that was not just that the Bolivian state took control of the sort of direction of the mines. It also replaced a community of engineers and administrators and the sort of the community around that, who were mostly foreigners. A lot of them were from the United States or from parts of Europe, or some of them were Chilean, and replaced them with Bolivian engineers. And also it replaced a lot of the contracts that were being made to sort of provision the mines with local or at least sort of Bolivian companies. And so what you had was a very small city that thought of itself as very cosmopolitan, that thought of itself as very connected to the wider world, that had a population of not just Americans and British people, but also a pretty large Arab population. The most famous union leader in Bolivian history, Juan Lachin, he's actually from Corocoro. Father was a merchant, I think of Lebanese descent, and his mother was a woman from Corocoro. And so you have this city that was a product of linkages to the wider world that becomes much more of a city that's now linked to the Bolivian economy, but a little bit more parochial as a result of that, right? So there's this replacement of the foreign population, as well as the foreign economic interests with local ones. And who fills in that gap is young men who are able to sort of leverage their position in the mines as mine workers, but who also have connections to the power holders from before. So for example, people who are more likely to be able to read and write are more likely to be labor leaders. People who worked in the electrical plant rather than as drillers in the mines are more likely to be able to take on these positions. And they're the ones who negotiate with the revolutionary nationalist movement. They're the ones who negotiate with the government before and after the revolution in 1952, and use their positions to sort of capture power within the mining communities, or within the mines themselves, as well as within the city of Corocoro. So we could, if you want to, talk about one of the documents I brought.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So one of the documents that I wanted to bring up was this telegram that I found in the Archivo La Paz. This was in one of the boxes of municipal, sort of assorted municipal documents from 1952. So it's a telegram, and it's dated the 31st of May, 1952. And it's addressed to the Minister of Mining and Petroleum. So that would be Juan Lachin at that point. And it says, you know, today at 11 a.m., I took possession of the Alcalde Municipal. So I am the Alcalde Municipal. I offer maximum collaboration to the national government. Yours, Mario Duran. Mario Duran at this point was the head of the local mine workers union in Corocoro. And so I saw this telegram and I was like, oh, wow, this is the moment, right? Like, this is the moment when the workers take control of the city government. And then I looked at it a little longer and I thought, but the revolution of 1952, the MNR took power after 4 days of fighting in La Paz in April 9th. And so what's going on at the end of May, right? Why is this happening at the end of May? And then I did some more digging around in the archives, and I found a series of documents sort of related to this power exchange. And what I noticed was that the alcalde municipal, who's before the revolution, is, let's see, a guy named Humberto Terán, and he's alcalde right up until about the 31st of May. And then for 8 days, the union leader is the alcalde. And then he gets replaced with someone else who had been mayor in 1951. He's replaced with like a local, you know, member of the kind of civic elite. This raised a big question for me, is like, what's happening here? Why did the mine workers take power in at the end of May? What was the negotiation? What did this transformation of city government actually mean? So when we think about the revolution of 1952, and this is another thing that I want to think about as a kind of a legacy or rethinking of the revolution, you've got the days of fighting in La Paz. And then you've got every day afterwards where the MNR, which is this civilian party that you know, has had experiments with power before, but really doesn't have a lot of control in a lot of parts of the countryside, as Carmen, your research, you know, as you are very, very aware, they need to figure out how to not just keep control of the country, but also enact anything that they want to enact, right? If they're going to transform, if they're going to do something like an agrarian reform or nationalization of the mines, which at this point was not a foregone conclusion by any means, they need power. They need infrastructure. And the Bolivian government in 1952 didn't have a very extensive reach into a lot of parts of the countryside, like didn't have the ability to enact sort of small local policies necessarily and make sure that if the MNR said something in La Paz, that was actually happening everywhere else. And so one of the things that was happening between April and May was a series of strikes, sit-down strikes, to force the national government's hand towards nationalization. This is something mm-hmm. that it took a while before the MNR was convinced that nationalization was something they had to do. But also at the level of the local government to figure out what the revolution was actually going to mean and mm-hmm. who was going to be part of the government going forward and who was also going to be the people who had social and economic power going forward. And one of the things that happens in 1952 is you start to see a real change in who is involved in municipal decision making. And after 52, the union is a crucial part of it. And it's the mine workers union that's a crucial part of it. Before 1952, you have a series of lawyers and merchants. If the unions are involved, it's maybe the bread makers, the bakers union. It's really more a white collar group of local elites who are making decisions, yeah. and also foreign engineers from the mines. And afterwards, the union is there. And while the union doesn't control the city government immediately after the revolution for particularly long, what they do get is the city pays for electricity in a lot of the union leaders' houses. The city ends up building a library for the workers. The city ends up including the union in a lot of just local decision making. And so you have this messy aftermath of the revolution where you see people who had been in power before 1952 are having to negotiate with a new actor that has a direct line of communication to the national government now, right? And so they have to take kind of a new social group into consideration. And incidentally, I look at this in my research, not just in terms of city documents or union documents, but one of the things I found was really a very dense and evocative source of this is judicial files. And so you have things like bar fights, you have divorce disputes, you see social transformations in the city life through lawsuits. And so, for example, someone who is being sued for, you know, getting into a fight with a merchant's son, those lawsuits start to play out differently after the revolution, where you see workers getting taken more seriously in the courts, and you see workers having more access to the legal system itself. And you start to see as well, workers and their wives suing other people for not treating them with respect. So I have the case of a miner's girlfriend, actually, who got into a fight with an employee of the company store because he called her a sort of a nasty name and he wasn't treating her with respect. And what you start to see in these cases is she says that I am a member of the miner's family, right? Like the workers in this town will be respected. And she was upset, not just about what he called her, but that he didn't give her the cut of meat that she thought she was, you know, owed. So it's not just a sort of symbolic issue. It's also very material. Like who has access to resources in this town starts to change. And how that starts to change is partially because of the union insisting and also having this access to political power at the national level. But it's also after the mines are nationalized, what you have is these companies are now, as I said earlier, you know, run by Bolivian administrators, but there's also some differences. For example, every local mining company, so the Empresa Minera Corocoro, as well as Comibol as a whole, has worker control representatives who are affiliated with the union, who have a lot of veto power over all decisions that are not strictly sort of engineering decisions in the mines. So you have union representatives with substantial control, at least for a while, over conditions of what the mining company does. And this is everything from, you know, what kind of budget looks like to who they're hiring and all these sorts of things. And what I argue in my book is that while this kind of power that the miners wielded nationally was pretty short-lived, so, you know, the mine workers were allies of the MNR government for a few years until the MNR government started pulling away from that. But at a local level in places like Corocoro and also in mining cities like Yayawa and places like Oruro, worker control and Wanuni, worker control had really substantial power for quite some time. And so this was another way in which the revolution actually transformed the life of small mining cities. But another way is through the infrastructure that the mines controlled. So based on laws dating back to the 1930s, the military socialist governments of the 1930s, the mines, if the mines were of a certain size, they were supposed to provide schools and hospitals. And so actually long before the revolution happened, you have mining communities having like higher rates of literacy, right, than your average rural community, because the mines were supposed to run schools for the workers. They were supposed to build hospitals. They had company stores. And in the case of Corocoro, the company stores that the American Smelting and Refining Company built in the 1930s and 40s, they were competing with merchants. They were sort of putting local merchants out of business. And this was one of the reasons that the foreign company was actually really unpopular in town. But after the revolution, the state takes control of those. And that also means that the union is able to negotiate about prices in the company store and prices for access to the hospital and, you know, who gets treatment in the workers' hospital. And those sorts of things end up mattering, I would argue, as much or more than a lot of the other sort of questions of, you know, even working conditions in the mines, because whose children get to go to school for free? Whose children get free breakfast at school? Whose children get their books and uniforms paid for? That starts to make a huge difference in these cities, where if your dad or older brother works in the mines, you get these things, and your neighbor who doesn't work in the mines doesn't get these things. And so what I argue in my book is that it's the social security apparatus, it's the kind of company welfare state that gets created around these company stores, around these schools and hospitals, starts to create a much larger community that is associated with the mines, and that has, even at a time when the workers' unions are battling with the Bolivian military politically, you know, even at a time when there's a lot of repression of mining politics at a national level, these communities have local power and they have access to resources, even if those resources are less than they were promised, right? It's not that these workers are, you know, paid really, really well. It's not that these workers, that these children are not also quite poor, but they have more and they have a field in which to fight for more. And this has both symbolic and also material like meaning. And so that's one of the things that becomes really important.
I just want to say go ahead. Whenever we thought about the revolution, the big three changes of the revolution, historiography usually tell us is the access to vote, universal suffrage and citizenship, and mines nationalization, which we usually think in these three big places, and then land reform. But what you're telling us is that this people is really gaining fully citizenship by acquiring not only access to vote, but also access to education, health, political participation, influence in the state apparatus. So there are ways in which we have not imagined yet how the revolution changed people's life in very, very concrete ways.
Yeah, that's a very concise and very eloquent way of putting it. Yeah, thank you. It's if we talk about the revolution in terms of citizenship, the right to vote was a very, very important deal. It really expanded suffrage in Bolivia, really did transform the country. But at the same time, that citizenship, came to mean different kinds of things. And there are these kind of intimate and everyday ways in which nationalizing the mines created a form of citizenship for workers that had a lot of meaning in those cities, in those places, but was also hierarchical and also exclusive, right? This was not a universal access to food and healthcare. This was access based on a kind of a corporate connection, right? A connection to the mining company. And one of the things that happens is that later, much later, critics of the revolution and critics of the mine workers in particular start to say that Comibol is bloated, right? Like Comibol can't sustain itself because it's an inefficient system and the workers are demanding too much. And one of the things they say is there are more people who work above ground in the mines than below ground. And that this is the sort of symbol of inefficiency. Well, why does that happen? It's because if you work for the mines, you get access to all of these things. And the other thing is when the miners send their children to school, they're not trying to send their kids to school so they can go back and work in the shaft and get silicosis, right? They're trying to send their kids to school so their kids will be engineers or teachers or have some kind of, so that maybe they could work as a clerk above ground, and they still get access to all those resources,
of course,
but they don't have the danger and they're not going to die at 40. And so it does kind of create this welfare state within a state. And generations later, you have the repercussions of that, which is that some people really find that vision very appealing. They have a nostalgia for this revolution that was. And you have other people who say that revolution passed me by and that the Bolivian state never gave me those resources. So the second document that I brought it's a page out of a legal dispute that was actually a child support case that started in the mid-50s and really went on for about 8 years. It was like from 1955, I think, onwards. The simplest version of this story is that a young man in an indigenous community called Caribaja, which is north and west of Corocoro, so it's in the highlands. It's very close to Corocoro, but in a rural area. This young man and this young woman have a relationship, and they end up conceiving a kid. And he argues that she was supposed to marry him, and then she rejected him. And that later he went on to marry another woman, and eventually he moved to Corocoro and became a miner. Well, so starting after the child is born, the woman's family start to try to track down the father to help support Fermin and his mother. Before the father moves to Corocoro, there's not a lot that the woman's family can do. Basically, he says, I did conceive this child. I had a relationship with the child's mother, but I don't have to recognize this child because I wanted to marry her and she didn't want to marry me. And so she rejected me. And so she sort of rejected the offer of support that I gave her at that point. And at this point, I have another family. I have a wife, I have children, I have siblings, and I have a mother I need to support. But so after the revolution, or after actually land reform, what happens is that her family doesn't give up. And the document that I have is a document where the grandmother of Fermin, so the mother's mother, is going to the courts and saying, because of the agrarian reform, this young man who has been working on the Sayanya, so the plot of land that he has usufruct rights over. He's been working this land. And so now he owns this land because of the agrarian reform, which means that he is wealthy comparatively, which means that he has the money to support Padmini, and he should be supporting Padmini. So you have this document where this indigenous woman, who she doesn't sign her name, right? She's not literate. She's signing with thumbprints. She's going to the courts and saying, I know what the agrarian reform means. It means land to those who work it, right? And she's using this phrase and she's deploying it as a legal argument. She and the clerk who's taking down her testimony have this narrative of what the agrarian reform means. And he writes back and he says, the agrarian reform does not mean that a man can kick his parents off the land that belongs to them, right? He basically says, yes, I work the land on behalf of my mother. It's my mother's land. It's my family's land. We have to support all of these people. And so I'm not wealthy and I'm not the owner of the land. This is not a formal process of the agrarian reform in the slightest. This is a debate about the meaning of these laws that are coming down in these very local settings. And I love this document because it just shows how much everyday people were sort of taking the law into their own hands and thinking about what that meant. There's another case where a younger brother brings up his older brother to a tribunal for abusing his labor under the terms of the agrarian reform, because he says he's not getting paid and he's supposed to get paid now for working his brother's land. And his brother comes back and says, this is a longstanding agreement where I loaned him the livestock and he's supposed to work it and he's supposed to return the livestock to me. Like, this is a custom that is very well established. And it's interesting to think about how these new laws were being taken up. But the reason that this matters to the mines, to my story, which is located in the city of Corocoro, is that the father of this child moves to Corocoro and he becomes a miner. And one of the things that happens that the MNR and the mining company do in the middle of the 50s is that they decide that they really need to take care of Bolivia's children, that one of their concerns is child poverty. And what they start doing is a policy where if a woman can prove that she's had a child with a minor and that he's not supporting her, his paycheck will get docked, right? So it's not just that the courts are saying, you owe this amount of child support. It's that the mining company is taking money out of his paycheck and giving it to someone else. And that is something that the Bolivian state did not have the ability to do before. And this is something that the mine workers are consistently in the court record, just like furious about, right? Like, I should be able to control my hard-earned labor. But there's this pronatalist bent of the Bolivian state that's saying, we need to take care of child poverty. Children need this kind of sustenance. And therefore, we are going to direct some of the resources, some of the wages to the mother of the child. And that also includes sort of access to goods at the company store. And that also includes lactation subsidies that women are entitled to. And so when he enters into the mines, he thinks of himself as not necessarily a rich man, right? He thinks of himself as doing this to support his extended family, including his legal wife. But at the same time, the Bolivian state, or the courts actually, the courts say, well, you are the father of this child. And even if you're not married to his mother, and so you owe child support. And so what you have is these two competing definitions of family, right? This is long before paternity tests are a thing, but the courts decided that he was the father. And it conflicts with his idea of, you know, I owe obligations to my family that I choose, legally recognized, and my extended family. And he also, when he starts to being forced to pay child support, he says, okay, well, when Fermin turns 5, I want him to live with me. So it's not like he fails to recognize his son in a sort of unofficial sense. He just thinks that he has the right to say, I'm not legally officially recognizing him, so I'm not going to give him child support until he's old enough that he can live with me. And there's a whole series of really interesting debates where the father also says that until the child's 5, that the child really doesn't represent a drain on the mother's resources, which is really interesting. The state doesn't agree with that, but it's a really interesting sort of way of thinking about children, that like, oh, she's probably fine. She can support him. And so this case, which travels from the countryside into the city, takes on a really different form once he is a paycheck earning miner. And so you can see how some of the policies of the revolutionary government that were concerned with poverty reduction and child welfare, and also were in some ways designed to be, you know, benefits to the workers, saying, you know, you're going to get a bonus every time you have a kid. These things ended up actually being resources that not just the workers themselves, but their extended families and even their estranged partners could use. I don't want to argue that women had a huge amount of power in this situation, but I am arguing that women got access to new levers that they could use to try to control their circumstances, to try to, you know, protect themselves a little bit, to try to get a little more food for themselves and their children. And that the MNR's vision of the revolution and that the way in which Comibol nationalized the mines helped them do this without intending to in the slightest. I think one of the legacies of that is one of the politically powerful groups that comes out of mining communities in the 1960s is the Housewives Union, right? So you have, you know, a union of women who unionize as housewives of miners, and they become this sort of potent political force in the human rights struggles of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And they're very clear that they are housewives, right? This is not single women unattached to miners. They see their role as because they are mothers, because they are partners of miners. This is where they derive their political legitimacy. But I think that the fact that this powerful group organizes itself in this period, right after the welfare state within a welfare state, gives a lot of resources to women in these communities. I think those two things are not accidental. I think you can see women taking power and then exerting a political voice. And so this is another legacy of the revolution and a contribution of my work, because certainly people have talked about the Housewives Committee.
Up to today, right?
Up to today.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's still here. It's something that people have written about. And, you know, June Nash was writing about, and you have one of the famous testimonials to come out of Bolivia is, you know, let me speak, Domitila Barrios de Chungara. She's a Housewives Committee member. This is not like a hidden story. But what I do think is important is that there's a connection with how political and economic power shifted after the revolution in these mining cities that meant that a certain kind of politics became really important. And that was people who were willing to fight for access to the company store, access to hospitals, access to schooling. These were things that mattered a lot to both men and women. And it gave women a sort of material way to exert their voice as well. Because one of the things you start seeing when the relationship between the mining union and the MNR and the state breaks down in the 60s is the Housewives Committee starts doing things like taking over company stores, or holding hostages, or sort of, you know, battling over this infrastructure of anti-poverty reduction, rather than just battling over, you know, rights to holidays or worker hours or wages or something like that.
And these are, and I think your work and my work are very similar in this. These are structures and these are practices that do not end in 1964 when the MNR falls, but they continue. Yes. And that's kind of the power of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is the biggest thing that I want to argue we should rethink about the revolution. And your work does this really well too, which is to say the MNR fell from power in 64 and you have military dictatorships from 64 into the 80s, but the mining company was still there. And on a local level, especially, and even on a national level, the mine workers remained a force to be reckoned with. Shot at, certainly, you know, oppressed. There were battles between the Bolivian military and the mine workers, but that didn't mean that they weren't a powerful force in the country. And the military governments of the 60s and 70s did not shut down Comibol. And so what you have is into the 70s, worker control representatives are still powerful players. The mine workers are still powerful players. That starts to erode at a certain point. But, you know, I've talked to children of mine workers who are my age. They were children in the 1980s and who talked about calling the children of the union mine workers the Hakuntantas, is the big bread. They got free breakfast at school. Mm-hmm. So wow. They had food. you know, they got better toys at Christmas. And so this would be like the child of a salaried mine worker and the child of a cooperative mine worker who is, you know, working in a similar mining camp, similar conditions. You know, both of them are children of miners, but one has a salary and the other one is working on their own account as a member of a cooperative. And it's not just that one gets a paycheck and the other doesn't. It's that one, you know, gets a school uniform for their children. Again, going back to that question of citizenship, that's a really long-lasting legacy of the revolution that is a kind of certain groups of people who are still poor, still politically oppressed, but they have a different relationship to the state and they have expectations of belonging that their neighbors don't. So yeah, so that's one of the things that kind of comes out of my research. And the other part of the story, and I have an article that's coming out in the Bolivian Studies Journal later about mining cooperatives specifically. What I argue is that when the Bolivian state in the 1970s, for example, could not politically dismantle Comibol, what they did instead was just sort of chip away at it by opening up more and more pieces of the mines to cooperative exploitation. Mm-hmm. So saying, you know, we're not going to open a new mine where the union would get involved, where there'd be salaried workers. Instead, we're going to cede this section of the mine shaft to a group of people who are now, you know, working it as a cooperative. And if they make money, great. And if they don't, that's too bad. Those cooperatives had to sell their ore back through Comibol. So it was still a sort of wing of, you know, the Bolivian mining economy that the Comibol relied on. But what it did was it created, you know, a group of people with zero contract hours, with like, you know, no worker protections. It's like that classic story of, you know, firing the union workers and then hiring people who don't have any protections. It's that sort of thing. But what you had was a growing population of people who didn't have the protections of the revolution in these same mining cities. And I think you can't understand the fights of the mine workers to protect their sources of employment in the 1980s. They sort of ran up against a Bolivian public that was less sympathetic than it had been in the past. And part of that is that this was a group of people who were protecting something that no one else had access to.
Elena, thank you so much for sharing your research with us, sharing your time with us. Thank you for coming to the program.
Thank you so much for your questions. It was a real pleasure to do this and to talk through some documents. And yeah, I look forward to hearing the rest of the interviews. Thank you so much. Mi gran tragedia terminará, hoy mejor esté aquí. Predestinado a vivir estoy en el santo cielo. Por eso a Dios le pido morir como buen minero. Minero canilla hasta imanta, minero gira causa tuní.
The song that you have been listening at the beginning and the end of this program is the iconic Bolivian song entitled El Minero by the group Sabiandina. This is, as I said, an iconic song that talks about the suffering and the sacrifice of Bolivian mine workers. And finally, I want to thank Elena for sharing with us a copy of the documents that Elena has been discussing with us today. You can find those documents uploaded in this website.